It is 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Over the course of the many years that I have hosted this program, there have been several occasions when I have spoken with authors who have written about one aspect or another of the Roman Empire. And of course, the Roman Empire looms large in the history of Western civilization, as in so many ways, the largest, most impressive, and certainly most influential empire ever seen in the Western world. But there are ways in which its greatness has been, in a sense, misunderstood or underestimated. And that is certainly the contention of my morning show guest today, Aldo Cazzullo, that in fact the legacy of the Roman Empire is still very much with us, particularly here in the United States. That there are many things about our daily lives, about the way our government is put together, the way that we interact, and so on, that can be tied in very direct fashion back to the Roman Empire. And he sketches some of this in his fascinating book called The Never-Ending Empire, The Infinite Impact of Ancient Rome, in which he not only sketches for us the centuries of the Roman Empire, sketching for us its development and its rise and ultimately its fall over the course of some 12 centuries, and points out some of the key figures within that history, but then also talks about some of the ways in which the Roman Empire and its legacy are still very much alive and well. It's a fascinating undertaking, and I appreciate this opportunity to speak with Aldo Cazzullo. He is a much-admired Italian reporter and journalist, currently serving as deputy managing director of the newspaper Corriere della Sera in Milan. He has a number of books to his credit about Italy and history, some 30 books, in fact, but this is the first one intended for an international audience, published by HarperCollins. Aldo Cazzullo, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much. I'm honored. Good morning to everyone.
Before we begin talking about your fascinating book, I wonder if we could just hear a little bit about how you came to be so interested in history, and also what led you to want to become a journalist.
Yeah. Because I am Italian. Italian is a very new state, but Italy is a unique country because Italy wasn't born from politics or war or diplomacy. Italy was born from history, culture, art, way of life. And so if I studied story, I studied also my country. And I found a very deep link between Italian history and American history, because I'm sure that America is the new Rome. The real heir of the Roman Empire is the American Empire. So America doesn't have 300 years behind it. America has 3,000 years behind it, just like China. And we have a common root. We, the Italians, you, the Americans, the common root is Rome.
Mm. In fact, the very first line of your book, that's introduction, is Rome has never fallen. And of course, that is not what we are taught in history class. We are taught that the Roman Empire indeed did fall. But in fact, what you're saying in the next line is the Roman Empire never really fell, nor will it ever fall. It has continued to live on in the minds, words, and symbols of the empires that came after it. I wonder, although we will be speaking especially about the ways in which the legacy of the Roman Empire is alive and well here in the United States. I think one of the things you point out in your book is that it is not just America that bears this legacy, but other empires that emerged in the wake of the Roman Empire also were deeply influenced by it, correct?
Yes. Every emperor considered himself the new Caesar, and every revolutionary considered himself the new Spartacus. Every empire in history portrayed itself as the heir of the Roman Empire. The Eastern Roman Empire, Constantinople. Constantinople was a prodigy, a miracle. The Byzantines resisted the Arabs, resisted the barbarians, resisted the Turks until 1453. The Holy Roman Empire of Charlemagne. Tsar and Kaiser are words that derive from Caesar. So the Russian Empire, the German Empire, we had the British Empire, who controlled India with a handful of soldiers, the majority of whom were Indian, just as Rome kept the barbarians at bay with armies composed of and commanded by barbarians. But the real heir of the Roman Empire is the American Empire. What was the symbol of the Roman legions? The eagle. What's the symbol of America? The eagle. What's the USA's motto? E pluribus unum, out of many states, one. It's a Latin motto. English is the new Latin, the language of the world. Yesterday I was in Washington, D.C. Everything reminds me of Rome, the Senate. Capitol Hill is named after the Roman Capitolium, one of the seven legendary hills upon which Rome was born. Jefferson Memorial is a copy of the Pantheon. White House, Treasury Department, Red Cross, Supreme Court are neoclassical buildings, Roman-style buildings. The words of politics, the language of the power, derived from Latin. People, citizen, liberty, justice, president, socialism, communism, fascism, liberalism are in Latin words. But the most important is the republic, res publica, public think. The idea that the state belongs to everyone was born in Rome. And the strategy of the American Empire is the same as that the Roman Empire, turning the defeated enemies into allies, just like America did with Germany, Italy, and Japan after World War II, and varying the military, cultural, and economical influence over occupation of territories. Real power, as the Romans knew and as the Americans know, is not over land. Real power is over minds and souls.
Mm. I want to read a moment from the introduction in which you really say that, I think, very well. You write, "The American Empire, just like the Roman Empire, was built by forging different alliances and pacts with different peoples and by valuing military and cultural influence over the occupation of territories, because real power is not over land, but over souls, not to mention the economy." So from what you are suggesting, I think, there have been other empires that did not exercise power in that way. I mean, they would take over a land and hold it militarily, and with that sort of brutal, and not that there wasn't some in instances of brutality within the Roman Empire, but in a sense, the way in which they occupied other lands was different, and it was not just about brute force.
Exactly. But for example, the Soviet Union occupied military the Eastern Europe by tanks in Budapest, in Praha. For example, the China is occupying Tibet. I think that American power is above all a soft power, a cultural power, an economical power. In America, I listen many people who said, we are declining. Just like the Roman Empire, Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, the great book from Gibbon. But America, trust me, is not declining. If there is something new in the world, a book, a film, a song, a medicine, a vaccine, a scientific discovery, a technological novelty, a cultural fad, it comes from the United States. The rest of the world, China included, or copies or buys. All the world speaks your language, listens to your music, watches your films, reads your books, treats itself with your medicine, buys or copies your technological products. Trust me, America is not declining. What's the secret of the American strength? The same of the Roman strength, openness. One could become Roman whatever one's origin, skin color, or religion. And now one could become an American, whatever one's origin, skin color, or religion. And it's extraordinary.
Hmm. This is something else that leapt out at me in your book, and this is something I, for one, had never really stopped to think about. I want to read again this portion from your introduction. One could become a Roman, whatever one's origin, skin color, or God. And people could become Romans while remaining Spaniards, Gauls, Thracians, Syrians, Greeks, Egyptians, or Nubians. The issues that Rome had to face, the migratory flows, the integration of foreigners, the permanent state of war, are the same as those we have to deal with today. And it is it's so striking to think about. I mean, when you think about the centuries that separate us, when we think about when the Roman Empire held power and where we are all these centuries later, and yet there are these striking similarities, connections between the two.
Absolutely. When Virgil had to choose an ancestor for the Romans, you know that the Romans had a terrific story. The Roman story begins with a kill. A brother, Romulus, killed his brother. And the story goes on with a rape. Lucrece was raped by the king's son, and the people revolted against the kings, and so the Republic was born. When the Romans became the master of the world, they needed a more glorious story, and they found it in Greece. Grecia capta ferum victorem cepit. In being conquered, Greece conquered her ferocious conqueror, the Romans. So, the Greek poem. Some claimed, we the Romans, we are the descendants of Achilles, the strongest. Some claimed, no, we are the descendants of Ulysses, the smartest. Virgil, in Aeneid, wrote, no, we are the descendants of Aeneas, the pious, the merciful. Aeneas is not a conqueror. He's a loser. He's not the master of his fate. He had to flee from Troy. But he flees from Troy holding his son, Iulus, the ancestor of Julius Caesar, by the hand and carrying his father, Anchises. Aeneas is the merciful who cares for the elders and for the descendants, who take charge of the past and of the future, who looks ahead and behind. And Aeneas is a refugee, is a migrant. This is a method of integration. And pietas is the Roman sentiment in which the Christians recognize themselves. It is the reason why Dante, the greatest Italian poet, chose Virgil as a guide in his trip in the afterlife, in hell, in purgatory, and paradise. Integration is very important. Again, really, we have to face now the same issues that the Romans had to face. The first one was immigration, and Romans faced immigration by integration. One could become Roman.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking in this portion of the morning show with Aldo Cazzullo about his newest book and his first book written for an international audience titled The Never-Ending Empire, The Infinite Impact of Ancient Rome. As we have been talking, the book is about the ways in which the legacy of the Roman Empire is still very much with us today in many parts of the world, but especially in the United States and in what we might think of as the American Empire, that there are all kinds of ways in which we, even without realizing it, are very much a direct reflection of the Roman Empire and what it stood for. Aldo Cazzullo, I wonder if we could just take a moment to talk about the challenge of understanding the factual history of the Roman Empire, since, first of all, we are talking about events in the distant past, And we're also talking about a history that over the years has been rather richly embroidered. That is, much has been added to the story. The things of myth have often been woven into the story. And it seems to me it becomes really difficult, really challenging for a historian like yourself to understand exactly what happened and when it happened and why it happened. Could you talk for a moment about the challenge of understanding the history of the Roman Empire and, in a sense, separating fact from fantasy or fact from fiction? How does a historian like yourself go about doing that? And with what resources, to what resources do you turn to gain a greater understanding?
Listen, about the Roman Empire, there are many, many, many books. Many people in all generations, in all time, studied the Roman Empire. So I think we can talk about it in a very simple way, because there are some facts that no one can deny. For example, you talk about before the permanent state of war, but one of the issues that now we have to face. Why, in your opinion, the Romans have won all the wars? Why? This is a great question. In my opinion, Rome could lose battles. In fact, Rome lost many battles. But at the end, Rome always won the war. Why? Because the Roman soldier didn't fight only for himself, his family, his tribe, his clan, just like the barbarians, like for the empire. I think we can say the same thing about the American soldier. The Roman soldier, the Roman legionary, was not a hero, was not a warrior. He was a military professional, and his goal was not a glorious death. His goal was a peaceful retirement, thanks to the land and to the gold taken away by the enemy. And the Roman general was not a heroic figure, also win or die. No, the Roman general was a planner, was a strategist, was an engineer who knew that Rome could lose a battle, and back then Rome would win the war. It's extraordinary. It's very fascinating, in my opinion.
When you look back over this long history, and again, we're talking about 12 centuries that you explore over the course of your book, I wonder if you could choose for us one or two individuals whom you find to be especially fascinating and maybe often misunderstood.
My favorite one is Caesar. I love Caesar. If he had just been a writer, a military commander, or a political leader, Caesar would still have gone down in history. But he has been all three of that things. A great writer, Gallia omnis divisa est in partes tres. The whole goal is divided into three parts. The beginning of the Bello Gallico is amazing. He was a great military commander. He was a great political leader. And he was also a great journalist. When he conquered the Pontus, winning a great battle in 4 hours, he wrote to the Senate, Veni, vidi, vici. I came, I saw, I conquered. Three words, 12 letters, the first tweet in history. And he was also a great lover. He was called husband of all wives, wife of all husbands. He made the first triumvirato, an alliance with Crassus and Pompey, but he had a lot of affair both with the wife of Pompey and the wife of Crassus. And he had also a love affair with the king of Bithynia. To mock him, his soldiers called Caesar the queen of Bithynia. So it's a great story. It was a little bit megalomaniac. When he was 32, he got his first political charge, procurator in Spain. He went to Cadiz, to Gibraltar, where Hercules had erected his columns to say it is the end of the world. There was also a statue of Alexander the Great, and Caesar had an emotional breakdown, bursting into tears. His companions asked him, why are you crying? Because I think that at my age, Alexander the Great was the master of the world, had conquered the whole world, but me, I haven't yet done anything glorious. And the companion said, you are crazy, Caesar. Rome is not a kingdom. Rome is not an empire. Rome is a republic. And we, the populares, we are losing the war because the power was in the hand of the optimates, the aristocrats, the senators, Pompey, Sylla, Cato, Cicero. But Caesar wanted to become the master of the world, and he became the master of the world. And when he, before being killed, he was planning to conquer also Persia and Germany. Yeah, a little bit megalomaniac, but surely a genius. Augustus was not a genius. Was a wise and cruel man, and he died in his own bed. Unfortunately, we cannot say the same about Caesar.
At one point, you talk about one of his great rivals, Pompey, P-O-M-P-E-Y. And at one point, as you are describing their struggles with one another, you say Caesar and Pompey were not just two rivals. They represented two visions of Rome and the world. Could you explain the difference between their visions of what Rome was supposed to be?
Pompey was a man of the past, was a man of the Senate, was a man of the aristocrats, was a man of the Republic, yes. But Rome became too big to stay a republic. Caesar was a man of the future, was the first emperor, was the real founder of the Roman Empire. How did he do it? By an alliance with the people. He was the leader of the populares, the People Party. It was, for example, he supported the free distribution of wealth. And when he died, you know that Brutus killing Caesar made two political mistakes. The first, some said, let's kill also Antony, the leader of the Caesar's legions. Brutus said, no, it's a tyrannicide. Only the tyrant, only Caesar has to die. Second political mistake, some said, let's take the corpse of Caesar and throw it into the river, into Tiber. Brutus said no. He was a great political leader. He deserves a great funeral. But at the funeral, Antony read the will, the testament of Caesar. Caesar left 300 sesterces, $1,000, each Roman citizen. And the people cried. The people, you know, that at every funeral, everyone mourns their own death. But that time, ever more so, because Caesar was a father for the people. And so the people revolted against Brutus and Cassius, the men who had killed Caesar, who were Pompeians. They have to flee, and Brutus has a vision, a shadow, who said, I am your evil genius. I will see you in Philippi. And the day before the great battle, Brutus asked, where are we now? What's the name of this place? They told him, we are in Philippi. So he understood he was going to a bad end. And, excuse me, again, you know that Pompey, after being defeated by Caesar, fled to Egypt, but Ptolemy, the king of Egypt, cut off his head and brought it to Caesar on a silver plate. And Caesar, what is the reaction of Caesar? Caesar burst into tears, saying, you deprived me of the only possible victory in a civil war to give salvation to the defeated. But Caesar didn't say that. If the Egyptians had not cut off that head, he would have done so himself.
He was a complex man, for sure. And you spend plenty of time in your book describing the many facets of Caesar, whom you say at the outset was one of the greatest men to have ever lived in any place and at any time. Well, let's talk for a moment about one of many aspects of the lasting legacy and influence of the Roman Empire. In a fascinating chapter towards the end of your book, when you talk about the ways in which Rome and its legacy have great influence over people like Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook, or Bill Gates, the founder of Microsoft, Steve Jobs, the founder of Apple, that these modern-day Americans, so well known to us, have at various points in their respective lives and careers evoked images from the history of the Roman Empire. This is something I think most of us as Americans will not know until we read your book.
Priscilla Zuckerberg, Mark's wife, wrote, "We spent our honeymoon in Rome, but I thought we were free, Mark, me, and Augustus, because Mark Zuckerberg wanted to be a photographer with all the statues of Augustus he met. There are many, 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 many statues of Augustus in Rome, because Augustus was the first man in history whose face was known by all of his contemporaries. There were in the Roman Empire 2,500 statues of Augustus, one in each city of the empire. You know, but Bill Gates is a fan of ancient Rome. Elon Musk proclaimed himself emperor of Mars, and I think it was a joke, wanted to have a physical fight with Mark Zuckerberg in Colosseum in Rome. Stay hungry, stay foolish. The famous speech by Steve Jobs was a Seneca, the philosopher Seneca's speech. I think there is a reason. I think that digital emperors look to the Roman emperors because Augustus and the other ones were the first to rule immense communities composed of people who would never meet physically, but who were born, lived, and died after one Caesar. For example, it's a joke, I know, but Mark Zuckerberg has his hair cut like Augustus. He ended his meeting crying with a cry related Dominium, and he called daughters August, Maxima, and Aurelia, Roman name. It's another sign of the fascination of the Roman Empire. But I think it's true for the USA's history from the beginning, because the founding father of the United States, Hamilton, Madison, signed the articles with the name Publius. Publius was one of the first consuls of the Republic. So they chose the president and vice president are the consuls, and the Senate is the Senate. Also, George Washington in 1777, when he rejected the peace offers of the British generals, he proclaimed the United Armies of America fight for the noblest of causes, freedom. The same principles inspired the arms of Rome in the days of its glory. So at the beginning, the USA looked to the Roman Republic. When the power of the presidency became stronger and stronger, some began thinking to the Roman Empire. And John Booth, Lincoln's killer, chose Ides of March as a code name for the Lincoln's assassination. The Ides of March was the code name of Caesar's assassination. Obviously, John Booth was wrong. Lincoln was not a tyrant. Lincoln was a great president. But, for example, as I end, when in June 1963, John Kennedy spoke in Berlin, he said, 2,000 years ago, the greatest pride was to be able to say, Civis Romanus sum, I am a Roman citizen. Now, in the free world, the greatest pride is to say, Ich bin ein Berliner, I am a Berlin citizen. The key phrase of the Cold War is carved out of a Roman motto.
It's a fascinating story, and one that I think many of us who fancy ourselves as knowing something about history come to realize we have not completely understood. Your book really reveals to us so much about the ongoing significance of the Roman Empire and how it is still very much with us today. Your book again is titled The Never-Ending Empire, The Infinite Impact of Ancient Rome, published by HarperCollins. Aldo Cazzullo, thank you so much, first of all, for writing such a fascinating book, And thank you for being my guest today on the morning show. I was honored to speak with you. Best wishes to you.
Thank you so much. I'm honored too.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And to finish out today, we're going to go to the Morning Show archives and replay a portion of my memorable conversation with historian Adrian Goldsworthy, talking about his book, How Rome Fell, Death of a Superpower. Your discussion begins in earnest right around the year 180. Tell us why this is a logical place to begin this discussion.
It's largely because you can see the empire is clearly healthy, clearly successful, clearly prosperous at this period. If you look in isolation at, say, the 4th century or the 5th century, the change from the start to the end is less dramatic. If you look at just episodes in the decline of Rome, you can almost be swept along by this idea that, well, it sort of transforms gradually, you know, it's not too bad, it's not too traumatic. The drop in level of prosperity, the drop in level of peace is not so clear-cut, not so sudden, not so bad. If you look at the earlier empire, if you take the wider sweep, then it becomes far more obvious that the decline is happening. And it's happening fairly steadily, and it is a long-term process. So if you look at the empire in 100, it's extremely successful. It's almost at its largest extent. If you look at the empire in 200 AD, then it's quite similar. Not very much has changed. If you look at it in 300, then it is clearly far, far weaker. If you look at it in 400, it's dropped again. It's divided into two halves on a permanent basis. There's a Western and an Eastern empire. You go to the year 500, the Western empire's gone altogether. So you need a broader sweep, a sense of perspective. Otherwise, you won't notice just how stark these changes were.
You tell us that in the year 180, or by the year 180, no one could seriously imagine, let alone remember, a world without Rome. I think that's really, that's hard for us now as we look back through the whole sweep of history to try to imagine a point in time where people did not know anything other than their own, in a sense, current existence, and the Roman Empire had been in place and so powerful for so long at that point in time that it's, in a sense, the only world and the only view of the world that anybody alive could possibly have.
And to some extent, it is a sign of the great success of Rome in that the Romans conquer an empire, they take these provinces, but they turn the people there into Romans. You have Roman citizens that are not descended from settlers. They're not colonists. I mean, there are some like that. But many of the locals, the aristocracy first, but then it filters down to other levels of society, become Roman. They start dressing as Romans. They get the legal advantages. They adopt a lifestyle. They might preserve all parts of their own tradition. They might speak another language to their tenants on their estates or even privately to themselves. But they are Roman. And when that happens generation after generation, it becomes such a natural thing. In part, it's also a reflection of the sheer fact that Rome is so much more advanced than anyone else out there. You know, the other options, the other alternatives, aren't very attractive. They're a lot more brutal, a lot more primitive. Rome is civilization. Rome is sophistication. Rome is being advanced, being more prosperous, more comfortable, more cultured than anybody else out there. So all of this reinforces itself. And then the sheer length of time that the Romans are successful, the Romans are dominant for. And when you think you're dealing with century after century, now very few of the more recent empires or powers have lasted anything like so long. If we go back, you know, the book starts in 180, it finishes in the late 5th century. If we go back a similar period in time in the histories of our own countries, things are radically different. And some of that's the greater pace of change in the modern world, but it also is a reflection of the sheer success of Rome. It was, by the end, by the 5th century, it was difficult to imagine the fall of the Roman Empire. It was difficult to imagine the collapse of Rome without really imagining the end of the world as well.
One of the abiding themes as you trace the slow decline of the empire is this matter of succession and of who becomes emperor. And in fact, with the death of Marcus Aurelius, who is, in at least in many, many respects, a fully able emperor, this the son who succeeds him, is it Commodus? Is that how we say
Commodus.
His name? Yeah, Commodus, is someone who kind of deteriorates into increasingly bizarre behavior. And when he dies, there is no heir to succeed him. And we see this succession over and over again of people sort of scratching and clawing their way to the throne, or people succeeding who have no business being emperor. It seems amazing to us that this empire that we think of as, in so many ways, sophisticated, would leave such an important matter, in a sense, to chance.
Some of it is the illusion that the Emperor Augustus created, that he wasn't an emperor, he wasn't a monarch, he wasn't a king. He was simply the first citizen, the leading magistrate, the most important citizen in the Republic, but he was still just a citizen. He was primus inter pares, first among equals, not the ruler. And that actually, that system does work fairly well for about 200 years. Yes, there are disputes over succession. It's often better in many ways if the emperor doesn't have any children of his own, certainly male children, because then the ruling emperor chooses somebody capable and also, as a rule, somebody a little bit older. You know, Commodus becomes emperor in his late teens, and he was considered not particularly bright and fairly lazy. You give any sort of teenage kid rule of the world and nobody to tell them no to anything and ultimate power, then the odds are things aren't going to go terribly well. So that's a bad thing. Emperors like Nero, who are young, tended to perform poorly. The change happens when, up until the end of the second century, it's still only really other senators who are considered potential emperors. If you're not a member of the imperial family itself, then you need to be from not just the 600 or so members of the Senate, but the top 10 or 20 who are the most distinguished, the most able, the most capable, important people with lots of clients, lots of connections of their own. Now that means that when there's only a limited number of potential rivals or potential candidates, the emperor can keep a close eye on them. It's much easier to monitor them, it's much easier to defend against rebellion. So although the system is informal, it tends to work quite well. The change comes really when a series of insecure emperors, because although they're senators, they're men who've won power through civil war or in other less than honorable ways, then they become insecure. They feel that they're rivals of the other senators. They won't trust them, so they don't give them positions of responsibility, which means that they then draw on the next level down in society, the equestrian order, the knights. Now, whereas there are 600 or so senators, there are tens of thousands of equestrians. They're a much wider social group. And when you get to the point where any one of these men who happens to command a few soldiers, who happens to command the imperial bodyguard, and is able to persuade enough people to murder the current emperor, when he can become emperor, it means that it's much, much harder to watch your rivals. You know, it's not obvious. The threat can come from so many different places, and you don't have to be politically important already to become emperor. All you need is the ability to dispose of the current incumbent and the ability to persuade enough soldiers to support you. So the whole system becomes far, far less secure.
It's as though it's suddenly open season. And on one hand, you might view that as something positive and liberating, and on the other hand, creates a certain kind of crisis and chaos. You describe, for instance, a certain half-century period. This would be between the murder of Alexander Severus and Diocletian's victory over Carinus. You say over 60 men claimed imperial power in that period. 50 years, 60 claimants to the emperor's throne. I mean, that right there tells us something about the state of affairs here.
Well, that's the change, because you compare it to the first two centuries, and there's nothing like that number, even in 200 years. And suddenly, because anybody could become emperor, and it means that often some of these people last a matter of days. Some of them might manage a few months, some are more successful. Several of them don't rule over the entire empire. They can only get a few provinces to back them. But everybody wants to be emperor, and you create a climate of suspicion where emperors can't trust their own commanders, their own ministers. They keep trying to find more loyal men, but because it's so easy to become emperor, it's very difficult to stay emperor. You know, you simply can't trust anyone. And the more nervous an emperor gets, then several conspiracies happen when men learn that they're going to be executed by the emperor because he doesn't trust them anymore. Now, at that stage, whether you're loyal or not, it's in your best interest. You might as well rebel because you're dead anyway, and your only chance of survival is to kill the current man and take his job. So it creates such a bad, unstable system that the thing just spirals out of hand and the cycle of civil war goes on and on, and it never really stops. That's the worst period, but right the way up till the end of the Western Empire for over 250 years, there are only about three decades that don't have a civil war in them. Mm.
You describe it this way at one point. It was a vicious circle. As each new assassination or rebellion by a usurper, no matter how quickly it collapsed, made a renewal of civil war more likely. In the 3rd century, the Roman Empire wasted much of its strength fighting itself. And of course, another point made by your book is that we have to couple this reality with increasing threats from the outside, and the fact that the Roman Empire was devoting more and more of its time and energy and resources into these internal struggles, leaving it less equipped than it would otherwise be to ward off the invasion of outside threats.
Well, the army and the institutions are just wasting their strength fighting amongst themselves, and it is striking that time after time, emperors are involved in a war with the Persians, say, or one of the Germanic tribal peoples, and if they hear news that one of their commanders has rebelled, that a challenger has emerged, they immediately end the war against the foreign opponent, even if it means making concessions to them to make them go away, and they rush off to deal with the Roman opponent. Because it comes back to the sheer size of the empire. The foreign enemies are not usually that serious as threats. They certainly can't defeat the empire. They will not be able to destroy the Roman Empire. They probably can't even take too much territory, at least not permanently. But another Roman, a Roman rival, will kill you and take your job. So the threat to the emperor is far more personal, far more direct, and it means that is always their priority. They're afraid of other Romans. They can live with, they feel they will always, well, we can beat the Persians next year or we can beat the Germans next year. It doesn't really matter. And it's not just that it weakens their capacity to fight, but it also weakens their will and their sense of concentration and purpose.
Hmm. It's also difficult to imagine how such a large empire could function without any of the means of quick, sometimes even instantaneous communication that we today so take for granted. And the fact that there was no way for a given emperor, for instance, to really know what was going on at the outskirts of this vast empire.
To some extent, I mean, the pace of communications can also be a little bit of a disadvantage as well as an advantage, because nowadays it's very easy for decision makers and political leaders on the other side of the globe to tell their representatives thousands of miles away how to decide things on a very detailed level, because they can be in real-time communication. With the Romans, particularly in the early empire, the emperor had to trust his governors. He had to trust his subordinates and representatives. And he would send somebody out to govern one of the German provinces or govern Britain or Syria. That governor would have supreme military and civil authority in that territory. And most of his decisions would have to be made by him without consulting the emperor, because there simply wasn't time, as things were happening slowly. That actually worked remarkably well, because the emperor couldn't try and run things from the center. It simply wasn't practical. He could restrain to some extent, he could issue guidance, he could make suggestions, but sometimes events happened too quickly. The problem was that later on, to make themselves more secure, the emperors start grabbing more and more power into their own hands. They divide the command so that, first of all, you make the provinces smaller, then you divide civil and military authority, so that there's no one individual in an area who can solve a major problem. The problem with that is that if they can't do it, if your representatives can't do it, then either the problem goes undealt with, or the emperor himself has to go in person and fight that war or reform that area or help to deal with whatever the crisis may be. And the emperor can't be everywhere at the same time. So when the Romans could delegate, when they accepted the fact that communications were poor, but they trusted enough of their subordinates to give a man control of an army without feeling that he is going to automatically rebel against you, then the system worked. As soon as that trust breaks down, and as soon as the emperors think more and more about, I'm afraid of that governor, therefore I'll make sure no one gets enough power to be a danger to me, they also create a system that becomes less and less effective at using their resources, because, again, there is simply nobody there who has enough power and authority to make the decisions and to order people to do what's necessary.
Hmm. You write it this way: each civil war cost the empire. Anything gained by the winning side inevitably had to be taken from the other Romans, and a prolonged campaign was likely to involve widespread destruction within the provinces where fighting occurred. Almost as important as the physical price of civil war was its impact on attitudes and behavior from the emperor down. Personal survival became the first objective of every emperor and shaped all of their decisions on the very structure of the empire. In the quest to protect themselves, successive emperors gradually reshaped the empire itself and, ironically enough, often made themselves more rather than less vulnerable. And, of course, if all of this becomes being a matter of self-preservation rather than what is good for the empire itself, it's little wonder that that it eventually declined and fell. In some respects, it's a wonder that it didn't happen more quickly.
Well, again, that comes back to its sheer size. You know, the empire is so big, it's so prosperous, it can sort of live off its fat for a very long time. There isn't anyone out there who's a competitor at an equal level. There isn't anyone out there, either economically or militarily, who can challenge Rome's dominance. So they don't have to be efficient. They can lurch along for a long time, and sheer size, the fact that also somewhere along the line there are still capable individuals in the hierarchy, there are still capable soldiers who are committed enough, who believe in the empire enough to do their job well. But it's harder and harder to get enough of those people to keep on dealing with each crisis, and you're less and less capable institutionally to cope. So it's, in a sense, there's a warning there for any large corporation or any large country that if you don't face an equal competitor, which many do not, then your own flaws, your own inefficiencies won't necessarily become obvious until perhaps it's too late.
In our closing minute, just touch on what I know is a complicated matter, and that is the care we have to take in drawing parallels between the fall of the Roman Empire and the fall of other empires closer to our own day. You are careful to draw some distinctions and caution us to not be careless in drawing parallels that really shouldn't be there.
Yes, it's the conditions were so different. Some things are just strikingly odd as well, in that whereas when the European empires and Britain's empire went in the 20th century, it was because peoples in Asia, peoples in Africa wanted to be independent. They wanted to have their own countries. That didn't happen for the Roman Empire. So there are some big differences, but I think in more general terms, we can see how people behave, and we can see how institutions can fail and can rot, and that often that rot starts at the top. So we can see a warning in Rome. We can see that if leaders forget why they are there, if institutions forget what their purpose is, then they will tend to become less and less efficient while probably getting more and more expensive in the process, but they can't use their resources well or effectively. So there are warnings in that, but if we look at the modern world, you know, things aren't as bad as they were in the later Roman Empire. You don't have modern democracies that are less likely to be troubled by civil wars, for instance. You know, you don't have that problem of succession and the political infighting and violence that became such a problem and lasted for so long till it was just natural for so many Romans. So there are very, very big differences.
All of that and more explored in this amazing book called How Rome Fell, Death of a Superpower, published by Yale University Press, the author Adrian Goldsworthy. Adrian Goldsworthy, this has been a great pleasure and honor for me. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for asking me.
If you are interested in hearing more from this interview with Adrian Goldsworthy from back in 2009, tomorrow's podcast of The Morning Show will feature this interview in its entirety. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Our skies will be mostly sunny today. We're headed for a high of 66 degrees, a little bit cooler near the lake. Clear overnight and mild, a low of 45. Tomorrow, sunny, and we warm to 71 degrees. 76 for a high on Sunday, 82 for a high on Monday. again with sunny skies. And we actually have sunshine, solid sunshine without any chance of precipitation in our extended forecast all the way now until next Thursday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha Racine, Elkhorn and Lake.